Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you doing, Robert?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling quite familial today in the sense of family ties. And I've been thinking a lot about my own family and also like family that aren't here anymore. For some reason, being in lockdowns made me think a lot about the past and my grandparents and my brother and kind of people that are no longer with us for some reason, which is quite intense, but also quite pleasant, actually. I'm quite enjoying having happy memories. So that's been fun. But the reason I bring that topic up is also our guest today is not only an award-winning, incredible actor and...
Multi-award-winning.
Yeah, he hasn't only won one award, he's won many. But he also has acted as a member of the royal family in The Crown. And his own family in real life has connections to art, which we will learn about. So family was definitely something I was thinking about while reading up about our guest.
Wonderful. Well, let's welcome to Talk Art... Josh O'Connor.
Hi everyone.
Hi Josh. How are you? How are we finding you in this lockdown period?
I'm kind of good. Like this sort of lockdown sort of suits me, I think. I was thinking about it the other day that in kind of normal, I thought it would suit me, but then socially I'm quite like to lock down day to day in normal life. And it's actually kind of a lot easier normally because you can just sort of come up with an excuse. But now, you sort of have to, people know you're free. And so they can kind of call you and there's no excuse.
Like, I can't, I'm away. Or
you're being like hounded. Yeah, hounded on Zoom today. Or house party or everything. WhatsApp.
Yeah.
We know exactly where you are. We know you're at home watching Netflix.
In fact, I actually just spoke to my uncle who was asking if he could call me, and I said that I couldn't because I was doing a podcast, and he sounded like he'd caught me lying or something.
Well, he can tune
he'll
know. In.
If he listens, he'll know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you are doing a podcast and you're doing an art podcast. And what's exciting and why we approached you, Josh, is that you have, which people may not know, you have so many art connections in your life and you yourself are an artist. You are someone that creates work and you show it on your Instagram feed, which has a lot of followers and a lot of excitement. So we wanted to just kind of delve into how art has become a big bit of your life because everybody knows you as an actor, but it feels like that's another side of your life that is as important.
Well, I think in some ways it's just sort of been present in my life always, as long as I can remember, really. So my grandmother was and is, although she's kind of less active now, was a ceramicist and kind of sculptural ceramics.
Wow.
My grandfather was a sculptor. And so sort of growing up, I was always kind of around their studios and that's sort of what I knew. And I was drawing from a very young age. I kind of remember my grandfather sort of teaching me to observe and draw and keep my pencil on the page and things like that. So it's always been sort of part of my life. And I think what's funny is that as you kind of, I think as I'm getting a bit older, I'm sort of starting to, it's sort of, I guess it's becoming more, it was kind of something of a kind of a private activity, and now it's mm-hmm. becoming something that I feel more confident to share, maybe.
Why do you think that is? Why do you feel confident now?
I don't know, really. And actually, I was thinking about it recently, and I don't know that it's, sometimes I don't think I am that confident to share it. And sometimes there are like days, so something happened where it was like a few months ago. Xavier Dolan, the filmmaker who mm-hmm. I am a big fan of, had kind of reached out to me and said he'd love one of my drawings. And so there was this kind of like real excitement of like, oh, someone likes a drawing I've done. And mm-hmm. of course I love his work. And so I was about to send it and then I never did. This is like a weird therapy confession, but I never did send it. And I think it was because in hindsight, I sort of got to the moment of, I put it in a nice envelope and wrote out his address and things. And then I just thought, actually, I'm not sure that this is public enough for me. I don't know that I feel that I'm ready yet to share my art in this personal kind of public way. Wow. And it seems really strange because obviously I have started to show stuff on Instagram, but it still feels like a very private thing in a weird
way. Does he know it's not arriving, or is he expecting it to come for the
person? Yeah, no.
Oh, he knows. By the post box, it's not coming. And you were gifting it to him?
Yeah, I was gifting it to him. I mean, I've had a few people have kind of reached out and said, oh, I'd love to buy one, or if, and in the past there have been a couple of occasions where I have you know, done a commission, or someone's asked me to do a drawing for such and such, mm-hmm. and I've done it, but mm-hmm. but really it's always been, for me, it's always been more of a just something I've always done,
a private thing.
But I guess Instagram's a funny old one, really, because in some ways it's turned into something for me which is about kind of showing off other people's art. And so in some ways I guess I've sort of backed away from it a little bit, but that's not to say that it won't come back.
But I think your Instagram feed is actually at Josh O'Graffy, so you have and your vibe on it is very arty. It feels very kind of modern, mid-century British vibe. That I think your art heroes are very rooted in, to me feels like your granddad's era,
For sure.
And his predecessors, like or the people like Henry Moore before him, and then
I love people after him
like Anthony Gormley. But the heroes you post are like Barbara Hepworth and Derek Jarman's in there. You've been a massive supporter of trying to get his Prospect Cottage.
Yeah, Prospect Cottage.
Which they've
reached. I think, they reached it today.
They've reached their target.
Did they? What, 3.5 million? Yeah. They got it.
They reached it today.
They've actually gone over today.
Yeah. Which is so amazing. Considering the timing, I think it's amazing that they've reached what they've reached. And
yes, in the current climate, you're like, wow, people are still giving money to them. Yeah.
It was so incredible, though, because like so many people, like Wolfgang Tillmans, you know, donated an artwork, like an edition, and so did Michael Craig Martin. And there were so many kind of ways to give money that were encouraged, if you know what I mean, by like buying something like a tote bag that might have had the
And Sandy,
the
do you remember Sandy Powell during the awards season? She had this beautiful white suit that she got everyone to sign, and then she auctioned it off for Prospect Cottage. So there's all these kind of... It was amazing seeing the whole kind of art world in different formats get behind this great man who was a great influence. I think that whole period, I mean, Derek Jarman in some ways I put in a kind of different bracket to the other ones you listed there, but I think it is something to do with a kind of crossover. To me, it's like a period that kind of... that generation of artists feel to me like a kind of strange crossover between craft and art. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think Hepworth maybe has that. I think, I guess like Bernard Leach, Lucy Rye, mm-hmm. Hans Copper, all those kind of, you know, I mean, specifically potters and ceramics. But I think I think when ceramics turn into sculpture and, yes. and what that kind of fine line is, that's always sort of interested me.
Is that what your grandma's work is like?
Yeah, they're sort of, my grandmother's work is sort of figurative. So they're quite bizarre. I mean, in some ways they're standalone, and I will post more of those actually, but they're, yeah. she was an interesting character in that she spent her life committed to that work, but it was very much craft. And so she would never exhibit. She would go to these kind of craft fairs and she would sell her ceramics. Mm. And one of the things that I've kind of got sort of obsessed with now is that I've collected so many of her pieces now. So my flat's kind of riddled.
But what, from the market, from the art market, you mean? You've gone and found them? Really? You've sourced them from places?
Yeah, some I found. Yeah, sourced them and
like where? Where have you found them? How did you get, like, you just typed her name into a search engine?
What's amazing is that if you look up Romola Jane, my grandmother, there are sort of, there is no, like, well, I think there is a small Wikipedia page, but there are sort of more, little blogs or things about someone from, I remember I found this little blog from someone from Lewes in Sussex, which is actually where my grandmother lived for a period. And so maybe that's where she found her, but she had collected two or three kind of scenes, ceramic scenes. One was like a cricket match. And the other one was a kind of Noah's Ark sort of thing, and she had two or three of these pieces, and she was reaching out to see if anyone knew of any other works, and I got in touch. This was years ago. I don't think I got any from her, but there are various accounts of people like this who really seem to appreciate her work but don't know enough about her, and I think that's what happens when you kind of. When there are more of these kind of craft fairs as opposed to exhibitions or kind of curated events, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I have a few of hers. I don't, unfortunately, don't have any of my grandfather's that are slightly harder to kind of come by. And
I saw that your grandfather, John Bunting, his sculptures are available sometimes. You can find like bronzes and. Mm. And also, he obviously made wooden carvings, but stone sculptures, like a whole array of things. But I did notice some of his online, like at Artnet or somewhere like that. Smaller bronzes.
Yeah, they are available. So he had a kind of his story is amazing. So he was at St. Martin's. He was a contemporary of Henry Moore's and knew Henry Moore very well. And there were lots of similarities in their sort of. There's a kind of plumpness to some of their figures that you can kind of see crossovers with. And my grandfather just sort of left London post-war and set up in Yorkshire. And he was the art master at Ampleforth. So for a long period, he was teaching young lads going on to do art, including people like Anthony Gormley, he taught, and a few others. And so he went off on that route. And then only later on in life were his sculptures suddenly kind of, as is often the way with artists, kind of well respected. And it was after he died that really people sort of started to jump at them. There are lots of them around in our family, but I just don't have
one. Oh, wow. And when he was teaching drawing, no?
Mm, exactly. So, which I think is really cool that they had it was like drawing master, which I certainly didn't have at school. But I think the kind of drawing was kind of a normal basis for all artists back then, right? I think when you hear accounts about art school, but certainly when my grandfather was at St. Martin's, it was like every single day was spent drawing. Everything was drawing. And then only later would you sort of introduce other formats, you know, be it sculpture or ceramics or, you know, you started everything with life drawing.
Talking about Anthony Gormley, who your grandfather taught drawing. Mm. his drawings are really, really great. And you don't always think of Anthony Gormley immediately, you know, to do with drawings. But we actually made a print with him last year for Save the Children for the charity portfolio we did at Counter Editions. And it was a print, a lithograph. And I think maybe it was a lithograph with a screen print. I can't quite remember now. But it was amazing to think that he was so good with his, as a draftsman and as a kind of, for drawings. It really surprised me. So I guess that was... I'm encouraged by your grandfather, which is
so cool. I remember I've seen a few things. I remember seeing a documentary about Anthony Gormley and seeing he used to do these huge kind of whirlwind squiggles and they're huge prints that I remember seeing available again on Artnet like a while ago, but again out of my reach, I was actually listening to one of your episodes on, is it Alvaro Barrington?
Yes, we love Alvaro. Yeah, he's so cool.
That's it. And I loved how he talked about drawing and how when he was younger, this idea of like sitting in a gallery and just studying a painting or studying a work of art, and just drawing for hours on end. You know, I always thought that feels like a lost art now.
Definitely.
So when you was a kid, I mean, your influences in your whole life have been, you're saying your grandfather and your grandmother, were they artists when they met each other?
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure, I hope I got this right, but I'm pretty sure they met at art school. And so there must have been, so my grandmother's also at St. Martin's. And I think that they're, I think both of them, it was a love of drawing. You know, the kind of, certainly when I was growing up, there was like, my grandfather's attitude was, until you've learned, it's like with any kind of format of art. And so, as a child, I was always kind of, I would look up to my grandfather and see him, you know, chiseling into wood. And I was like, that's what I want to do. You know, I want to do those kind of things. And he was like, there's no point going anywhere near all these tools until you've learned how to draw. And so he used to sit me down kind of quite a brutal way, and I just used to draw, and every time my pencil came off the page, it was like, well, that drawing's done, that's useless now, so you start again. And so you'd learn to like not take your pencil off the page, not look at your pencil page, and you just learn to life draw. And so he would just, I would sit for hours in either his, so my grandparents were split up, but either his kind of sculpture studio in Yorkshire or my grandmother's ceramic studio in Brighton. And I just sit there for hours and I just draw. And so there'd be like flowers on the table or a cup of tea, and I just spend hours drawing. And I think, you know, ultimately, I lost interest in that when I started going to school, but didn't keep it up. But I think there is something in the fact that when my grandparents were at art school, the fact that they would spend every single day doing that, you know, I can see how that kind of craftsmanship. Yeah. I think that to me is the thing that feels so special about art in all its forms, is when you can see the kind of the craftsmanship behind it. And I guess that's where kind of the love of people like Lucy Ryan and Hans Kolper and Bernard Leach and all those people kind of comes, really. It's that basic.
Are you talking about the continuous line then? If we look at like your drawings on Instagram, if people go and look at them, that's how your drawings are formed now. They seem to have like a continuous line drawing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think so. I think maybe that's where it comes from. I think there's like in reality, I think something stripped back, you know, the kind of minimalism of those beautiful Picasso drawings of just, you know, singular lines. I always find that, you know, in a world in which things kind of seem so complicated, I think it sort of feeds over into the acting world and into film and television for me as well. And I don't know if you find this as well, Russell, but for me, it's like I often, as a fan of actors, I always think that seeing an actor do less or seeing an actor not say so much or show so much is always more powerful.
Of course,
And emotional than seeing someone kind of over explain or over analyze. And
but and isn't that in the way that I, one of the biggest tips I had as a kid is that I used to be able to cry easy in acting. Yeah. And I remember one drama teacher say to me, don't cry. The point when you are interesting is when you're about to cry. But the moment you actually break crying, you're crying. We already know what that is. But if you're breaking, then we're with you because we're thinking, are you going to break? And I guess it's pulling everything back, reducing it to its emotion. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's to go back again for the second time. Is it Alvaro? It's Alvaro Barrington.
Alvaro Barrington. Yeah.
Alvaro. So again, in that episode, which I love so much, is this idea of him. But I think lots of artists having this thing of when you sit in front of a piece of art and you can sit in front of it for hours on end, then it's probably good. I mean, I think generally speaking, if you've got, you know, so much of, for me, so much of performance and storytelling, and likewise with a lot of fine art, so much of the kind of experience emotionally is what isn't there, or is what is kind of challenged to you, the viewer, in what you're kind of perceiving and what you're understanding from it. And so I sort of sometimes think stripping everything back is quite fun, I guess, is why some of those drawings have ended up the way they are. Really.
You've reduced them to what exactly, like the essence of what you want to show.
Yeah.
But they feel very illustrative, like, and very kind of like, they make me think of fashion, like YSL fashion sort of imagery, or cubist. There's definitely an Art Deco vibe in there as well. There's definitely cubism. Yeah.
I think fashion, often like fashion, the crossovers between fashion and art are always kind of fascinating, aren't they? I like, you know, people like Alistair McKellen and you know, in the photography world. But also I think some of those kind of, often you see like artists and their kind of early drawings feel very of the kind of fashion world, I think. Mm. So.
You've crossed that yourself, haven't you? Because you've collaborated with J.W. Anderson at Loewe.
Yeah, with Jonathan,
With Jonathan. And you've actually like modelled in his campaigns. And
yeah, I've done a few.
I was looking at those photos and thinking about you as an actor, because we were chatting to, I think it was Billy Porter yesterday, who said that that as an actor, you don't just wear the clothes, like... The clothes don't wear you, you wear the clothes.
Yeah.
And this idea that, like, that because as an actor you have a strong sense of character. Yeah. Exactly, yeah, theatre actor. But when I was looking at the photographs, I actually thought you were doing that in as a model. It was like somehow there was this narrative, there was a very strong sense of self and purpose within the way that you, it wasn't just like a kind of blank model, because sometimes when you see fashion photography, I'm just a bit bored.
No, it wasn't you, it was you, but it was a character you were portraying.
It felt like a character.
I think it's that's sort of like a defense thing, I think. I just think that the idea of doing any sort of modelling to me was like the worst, the most terrifying prospect ever. Yeah. Because it's not in any way something that I felt comfortable doing. And obviously, Russell, you've probably done plenty of this stuff in the past, where it's like, when you do those kind of editorial things and you're talking about acting, but that's not really, I can do the acting, but I'm not very brilliant at talking about acting. I'd rather do the acting, and I think it works in the same way with the kind of modeling thing. Is it's all well and good saying that you look, you know, often those kind of crossovers are, here's an actor who looks great in this film, and so I want to use them in a fashion shoot. But the reality is that they look good in that film probably because they are pretending to be someone else, and they don't necessarily feel comfortable in their own skin. And I often think that, when anyone ever asks me to be, okay, now do Josh. And it's like, well, you don't want to see Josh. You want to see, this character from this film or whatever it is connected with.
Although I must say though, with Loewe, I think there's such a history of like supporting the arts, and with Jonathan in particular, he loves the whole kind of he loves ceramics and crafts and he's really supported women artists and lots of different and queer artists and he has a similar and some of the things that he loves and that they've helped promote through craft at Loewe does fit actually with what you're posting yourself. So
completely.
And also probably what your family history is. So it's quite it is quite a nice
fit. I think he was really clever at, I guess he was really clever at kind of guiding me through that, really, because I'd had no experience of doing any sort of modeling before. I think there was, it never felt like this kind of relationship I've had with Loewe for however long it's been, like 4 years now. It never felt like now I'm going to go and do some modeling. It was always, the meetings I had with Jonathan were all we ever talk about, and we're good friends now, but all we tend to talk about really is craft, or is this artist that he's seen, and he'll kind of show me and I'll get really excited about, or
so cool.
You know, well, like
who has he introduced you to? Who is he?
So he's introduced me into a few. I mean, he was kind of very responsible for, so someone like Sarah Flynn. Do you know Sarah Flynn, who's a brilliant ceramicist kind of who I think won the Loewe Craft Prize actually a couple of years ago. So she's terrific, and there's a and he kind of introduced you to her. Also Joe Hogan, who's a basket maker who makes these I mean, they are baskets, but they've got these incredible forms and shapes, like very sculptural and huge kind of objects. So he's introduced me to plenty of people.
Do you have their work? Do you collect their work?
No. So it's something I've always, it was never something I considered really, was collection. And actually, again, Jonathan is someone who does collect and has sort of started to again introduce me to it, but I've never really, that as a concept was never really a thing to me, and I don't know I don't know where kind of people, I guess I'm interested in how people get to that point, like how kind of
it's a certain gene, right? I mean, it's like collecting is a certain gene,
because you some collect a lot, right, Russell?
I'm obsessive yeah. Like art collector, like all my money goes on art. That's where it all goes, and I've collected like books. I've got shitloads of books,
and I do as well. And it's actually how Russell and I met, was through our obsession with collecting. So,
but it's and a certain gene because my brother has.
Because people have talked about that to me. It's kind of it's like just something in you that feels like you need to kind of collect those objects or those pieces. Do you know?
You want to be custodial for things. You want to look after things and protect them, and be surrounded by things that inspire you. I've got a very visual mind, but then my brother doesn't have any. Like, he has bits and bobs. He has a nice house, a nice interior, but it's not like he cares. But I'm the complete polar opposite, where I'm like, I have to know everything. And
when we did that, when we did that New York Times article, I think we both realized then that it came from childhood, because both of us had collections of things when we were kids.
Yes.
And I think it stayed the whole way through our life. And I even remember obsessively wanting to know about all different kinds of creative things to the point where, you know, you'd have all these little collections of things. And I think it's that gene, whatever that is, stays with you. Yeah. You know, it's a really funny thing, actually.
I think a year or so ago, I bought my first ever piece of art, and I think that was it's quite a big oil on canvas by a guy called Max Wade that I'd seen in Cobb Gallery. Do you know Cobb Gallery?
Yes, I do. I know them really well.
Yeah, and so I'd seen that, and I just got my flat, and it was kind of this. There was this big space on the wall, and all I could think was, well, there is something that needs to fill this wall, and it needs to be look sort of like this. And then they just stumbled across this piece of art, and then got really interested in these brilliant works. And Max is amazing, actually. Makes these kind of abstract pieces. So I bought that, and that was the first time. But afterwards, I remember meeting with Jonathan Anderson and we were talking about it. And he was like, do you think you've got the bug? Like, do you think you're now going to go and do this, buy this and buy this? Mm-hmm. And I was just, for me, it was like, well, no. And I remember actually, Russell, you were asking it the other day. And I was like, I just don't know if I've got enough room. I don't have room. And so I think more what it would do more to me is kind of create anxiety of like, where am I going to put this? To me, yeah. It's like, I want to have, you know, the dream is obviously to have, you know, some big building with like, you know, polished concrete floors and beautiful oak wooden plinths to put on ceramics. But okay. Until I have that vast space, it's like in my, you know, one bed flat in North London, it's going to look rubbish.
They do always describe collectors as people that, you know, just keep buying even when you don't have the space.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like, you know what I mean? Yeah. That is the definition of a collector.
Yeah.
You need Art Anonymous.
It's like when all your cupboards are full, when all your shelves are full, when all the wall space is full, when your ceiling is full, and you've then got storage, that means you're a collector. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I sort of like the idea of it. So maybe there is capacity for me to kind of go down that
I think there way. Is, and I think we can encourage you.
I like this lifelong mission of kind of trying to curate your grandmother's works back and your grandfather's. Yeah. Do you live with those?
Yeah, so I live with a lot of my grandmothers, actually. And that's a good point. I think that there is, I like what you said about the bit, kind of the idea of being a custodian of this stuff. And I think that is something that I can liken to and I can empathize with, because I do feel great pride in kind of historical artifacts, I suppose, and it's particularly with my family. But I mean, actually, as a kind of Brit, you know, I sort of the idea of a kind of I remember there was an amazing experience I had when I was quite young, where I went to, so I grew up in Gloucestershire, and there's this Roman museum in Cirencester. And in this museum, it was fairly boring for a young guy going to this Roman museum as a school trip. But I remember the one thing that felt really impactful were how many of the exhibits in this museum were pots. And so many things that survive from that kind of period were these ceramic pots. And to me, that's always been, you know, they're very functional objects, but they were always extremely intricate and beautiful. Mm-hmm. And so I guess there's something about, you know, particularly with craft, like, and kind of an object that's been created by hand, the idea of holding on to that and being a custodian to that maybe that's my sort of link into it, and maybe that's where I'll kind of
the history fall of it into all, being like a collector. The human condition and what it is more of a practical craft. There's a practical background rather than just visual art, which is there to be admired. It's actually there to be used,
and there's a story to it as well, and there's always a kind of a narrative that you can either create, or that in this case with my grandmother, there is a story behind it. And there's nothing better than, you know, showing your friends a piece of art that you can say, well, that's what, you know, that was my grandfather's. And
amazing. My God.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing.
I've always loved ceramics, and even when you mentioned basket making, in relation to nature as well. Like, you very much get this kind of sense of, like, the earth and, like, the materials, you know, like, somehow, like, taking
the clay or
the raw
wood
clay
or it's all
and then
locally, locally sourced, isn't it? Organic.
I just love all that stuff, though. Yeah. Like, I think that's why craft is so, like, special as well, because it's got that. Somehow, I know the oil paint, you know, is also from nature, you know, a lot of the time, but like it's also, it's not because of pigments and things like that. But I still think, you know, ceramics and pots and things just have a more direct.
I think that they're going through like a resurgence, and I think there is, and I think
back.
It's because craft is back, and I think it's because there is a sort of a yearning for. Something that is organic or something that is created from earth that is purely, you know, hand to earth, you know, whatever that
totally.
Is.
Totally, yeah.
And a skill. People want to see that.
Yeah. But even those photos of you in Japan, you know, at like Mount Fuji and Lake Aishi and for the adverts, I felt like those photos were so like you with nature and like, you know, with the amazingly crafted... what's it called, like paddle for canoeing and stuff like that. Like, but it was all visually so like beautiful, but also very handmade. It was really
well. Clever. It's been such an amazing experience again with the Loewe guys, because I think very early on, the first two campaigns I did were with Stephen Meisel in New York in his studio.
Who
is amazing. And
what
and
was that experience like then with him? What's how does he work?
Completely surreal. So I'd done a kind of small side campaign with Dwayne Michaels, who I can tell you about after. But we'd done that, and I'd met with Jonathan for a cup of tea, and Jonathan had said, "Okay, so you're going to go to New York to see Stephen Meisel, and you just have to he was like, it is going to be strange, but you just have to accept it and just have to know that he's a genius and it will work and it will be brilliant. And so that kind of initially set off all the anxieties imaginable.
Yes. Emotional wreck. Why is this not going to be easy?
Yeah. This is going to be a disaster. And so I went, I remember flying out, and it was also, I think it was maybe the first time I'd ever been to New York as well. So there were so many kind of things going on in my head of sort of terror and excitement and also kind of fear of like, well, this is proper modeling stuff now. It was like, the Dwayne Michaels stuff was kind of, again, felt more artistic in the sense of like, you know, part of that shoot, I interviewed him as a kind of some video content for Loewe. And so that felt more kind of collaborative. This was like, Steve Meisel shoots models and in a beautiful kind of fashion chic way. And I didn't feel like that was me. And I went there. And so we arrived at his studio and you don't meet him. There's kind of a huge studio, so many people working there, you know, Pat McGrath doing makeup and all these amazing kind of figures. And then at some point you wait sort of 6-7 hours. And then at some point someone says, okay, Stephen's ready for you. And then you walk in and you spend maybe 20 minutes in front of the camera. And it's just like shoot. He makes you write down a playlist of your favorite songs and songs that you like, and then he'll blast it out. And it felt magical. I mean, it did feel very, it felt like a performance. It felt, you know, having had all those anxieties going in, it never felt, as soon as I stepped into that room, as soon as it was me, it felt like it was me, Stephen, and the camera. It did change. And I, you know, all those fears kind of dropped away. So
he made you feel really comfortable when you were able to like really access. Yeah. Wow. Are you pleased with the photos?
I did love the photos. Wow. I think it took me a while to love them, and it took me sort of, you know, it's like, I don't know if you find this, but if ever I see a film or a film that I've been in or a TV show I've done, it sort of takes me 2 or 3 years before I can actually go, oh, that was all right. Actually, you were quite good in that.
Oh,
or
my
you did
God,
all right
yes,
in that.
Yes.
It takes me a long
yes,
time because actually the first few viewings are actually all you're looking at is, what is my hair doing? Why do my ears look like that? Like my eyes look funky.
I've got the ear thing as well, mate. Don't worry.
We've both got the ears thing.
Yeah, if they light you from behind, I'm like, why do I look like a beacon of light now going through my earlobes? Yes.
I think it was the same thing with myself. But I think going through that journey with Jonathan and the team was like, we had to do that in order to kind of discover the Isle of Ave nature stuff, which is much more, it's more in touch with nature. It's more, it feels more me than anything
else. And that was
else.
A different photographer, wasn't it? That was Gray Sorrenti.
Yeah, Maria Sorrenti's daughter. She's 18, which is kind of ridiculous, but she's extraordinary. We just went around Japan for 4 or 5 days, and she just shot me, and we, you know, we'd walk through a forest at the base of Mount Fuji, and she'd just go, oh, that I can hear a waterfall, and then we'd sort of walk and follow the waterfall and the whole team, and then we'd be at a waterfall, and then she'd shoot, and it was,
wow.
I mean, it could not be further from, you know, Meisel building a waterfall in a studio, which is what he did with me. So it's kind of, I mean, it's like the total polar opposites, but, it's a pleasure. It is a total treat. Again, it's kind of those photographers like I think Alistair McLennan, you know, I think has that thing of the crossover between.
Have you worked with him? Have you been photographed by him?
I haven't actually. No, I've never been photographed by him. And I'm kind of huge fan of his. And there's been a couple of occasions where we've just missed each other. Like he was supposed to shoot a campaign, I think, or there was some talk of him shooting a campaign or a kind of editorial thing, actually, I think, with myself and Francis Lee after God's Own Country came out. And there was a period, I think, where he was being talked about for something else. So there's been a couple of occasions where we just missed.
A little dance around.
It's definitely a little dance. It's a dream. He has that kind of thing, doesn't he, where it feels, you can see, when you see an Alistair McLennan photograph,
you know it's his.
You know it's his, and I can't really pinpoint why, but I guess that maybe that's when it transcends into art as opposed to just editorial fashion.
Now, talking about art in kind of in different mediums, I actually think Francis Lee is a really amazing filmmaker, like verging on art, because it's so special the way that he makes films. And the first time I ever saw you acting was in God's Own Country, which is such an incredible film. And if people are in lockdown right now and haven't seen it, please watch that film. We actually mentioned it in one of the earliest episodes of Talk Art, I think, because I was really touched by it. And I know Sam, who's Francis's like partner, and I'd heard a lot about the film, and then when I saw it, I just could not get over how good the film was. But what was it like working with him? Because he doesn't seem like a conventional film director to me.
No, I mean, again, he's someone who, you know, lives in a hut in Yorkshire in the middle of nowhere, and kind of lives an existence. You know, he consumes art in a similar way to, I think, all of us guys do. You know, he's a lover of art, and I think. But kind of actually that what I was touched on earlier about this, the idea of simplicity and stripping things back, I think is something that sort of interests him. I don't want to speak for him too much, but I think that was like kind of a collaborative thing that we had together was, you know, in that film in particular, it's all about what's not said, and it's all about a kind of a brooding presence as opposed to, you know, it was kind of, you know, I'm a middle-class boy from the Cotswolds, who, if I have emotional problems, I can talk about them. In Yorkshire, working on the farm, they don't talk about these things. There's no kind of outlet. You know, there's no outlet. I always thought it was really interesting after that, you know, when we took that film over to the States, and we took, well, I think we opened it at Sundance, and there was kind of, I remember questions coming in about, like, do we think that Johnny Saxby is a repressed gay man? And it was like, not at all. He just doesn't talk about it, and sexuality isn't something that he talked about, or the idea of being loved and loving isn't something he talked about. And I think what Francis does so well in that film and in his kind of films going forward is that he doesn't ever feel the need to express or over express an emotion or a shot or an image, whatever it is. You know, it's always, it's kind of, it's sort of clear and concise and minimal. And that's what's so clever and powerful about him.
Yeah. It's a different way of communicating. I think there's a quote that he says about the character and about that world, about like you being repressed homosexual and you're not really. He says, because people work so hard in that part of England that as long as you work hard, no one cares who you sleep with. It's literally like the priority. Right. The priority is like the work. Everything else, just do what the fuck you want, but you make the work good.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I think that's what's so wonderful about that story is a guy who never actually really does find a language to articulate an emotion. But basically, it's about a young man trying to understand what it feels like and what it means to make a relationship work and be in love and receive love. And actually, it's, you know, it's this amazing, you know, what people sometimes forget about Francis is that he is a brilliant filmmaker, but he's an unbelievable writer. And when he writes, you know, there's a line at the end of that film where he says, "I've come all the way up here on a coach and everything." And that's his way of saying, "I love you," but it's, they don't have that language, or this character doesn't have that language. I always think that's kind of, incredibly kind of simplistic and powerful, and the ability to reduce it and bring it back and hold off on those things has always kind of impressed me.
Didn't you get sick on that as well, talking about like the current climate of washing hands? Wasn't there a moment in that where they had to stop filming?
They did. It was like they stopped filming for a whole week, and I think there was a big issue about washing hands on that. I think, because I was talking about it the other day, because I've, as we all have, I assume, been washing our hands vigorously.
Yes, I've got flaky, scaly lizard skin.
I actually had to put hand cream on before this episode.
They're ruined. They're ruined, so Josh. They're ruined.
I'll never be working for the Wavy again.
Not as a hand model, no.
That's as far as I'll ever get, probably, as a hand model.
Yeah. But they're really bad. And I remember having this, I was thinking about it. I was like, when was the last time I had to wash my hands so vigorously and so consciously? And it was God's Own Country. So I was working on the farm as we were shooting it. And so there was sort of days where I'd be like delivering a lamb for real. And then they'd say, okay, Josh, just quickly clean your hands because we're going to do a take. And you go, yeah. And you wash your hands of blood and then you do a take, like some romantic scene. Mm. And I think the kind of, I feel like the hysteria of being on a farm and also trying to be an actor compared to now feels quite sort of similar. But I did get, I got very sick and sort of lost so much weight and looked like a skeleton. Awful.
Do you find it hard to see yourself looking like that? It works for the character,
For the character. Do you know what? It's actually kind of easier than most things. You know, I think sometimes when you get to go on like a kind of more transformative experience, yes. I sometimes feel like that sort of, I guess it's easier to warrants. Watch because it doesn't, yes. yeah, warrants. If it feels like you've done, you're not looking
you've
at yourself.
Or, you've done the work.
Yeah, you can kind of, you can make the excuse of like, oh, that was me doing a performance. I don't actually look like that. Or, it was kind of, I actually remember a friend coming out of, not a close friend, a friend of a friend coming out of Seeing Gods and Country and saying, God, your ears are so, like, stick out so much. And I remember thinking, nice. Well, they do. Yeah. I mean, they do. Yeah, that's not prosthetics.
That was your review of the movie. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and that's what he did. But I remember
he was a critic. Yeah.
Really? But yeah, exactly. But I feel like I remember feeling a little bit sort of like I had a defense up. I felt like that was somehow I'd achieved something because if he hadn't noticed that in real life, because of course my ears are the same, then I must have done something right. But maybe not. Maybe they were just so extraordinary that he couldn't focus on anything else.
I know I had that experience. I was doing a play at the Royal Court called The Pass. So I was playing this footballer and I was like...
I saw it. Did you see it? Yeah, I saw it.
Oh, amazing. And then I was doing... Then about 3 weeks into performances, I was doing a TV show, a comedy for ITV called The Job Lot, which is this comedy set at a job centre. And I was getting up at like 5:30 in the morning filming... then going to the theatre and doing the show in the evening. So for the first week, I was okay and I was filming. And then I got food poisoning at the weekend. And then on stage, I was skipping loads and I skipped over a shot glass and bust my ankle, but I was still having to continue doing the play. So suddenly, I looked horrific. So there's two episodes of The Job Lot. Well, literally, I look like I'm about to die. I look like I've just got some... hideous wasting disease. I'm so pale and my ears stick out more because I'm look so chiseled with like sallow face. And I watch that now if I ever see it and I'm like, oh my God. And so many people were like on Twitter going like, is Russell Tovey okay? He doesn't look very well. And I was like, I'm not. I was so rough. It was and that was like after that, I was like, I don't think you could do that. When you're younger, you think, oh, I can film during the day, I can do a play in the evening, I can fit in a voiceover. I'm writing my own autobiography and you think I'll do it all. You can't. It's like when something knocks you back. It was so hard.
But also those things are so kind of shocking because they are those moments exist and exist forever then, right? I think that's the hardest thing I find is like when something comes out and my image is there and exists, especially with kind of television, that's it then. It's sort of there's no going back.
And with streaming, it just lives there, just circulates, doesn't it? With streaming. Horrifying. Sometimes back in the day you'd do it and then it'd be on and off and you'd never see it again. And now it's like, oh okay, there's that show that I can't stand. There it is. Yeah, everyone's watching it. Thank you.
I think it must be the same actually for a lot of artists. And I remember reading something about Georges, is it Braque? Who did
George Braque
was talking about, I remember reading something about one of his paintings that he wasn't, I don't know whether he was like a fan of it himself or whatever, he was never like happy with it, it felt like it was an incomplete work, but it existed and must have been privately sold or something, and that he couldn't bear the idea that too many people would see it. And I think like now, I mean, it'd be an absolute nightmare because you can kind of get these things at the, wherever you like.
Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah. So total not. It's me. Josh O'Connor's posting about them. So, useless.
But that's the same for so many emerging artists that are creating work and then the galleries are like, get more work and they don't have time to sit with it. And suddenly a few years later, they look back and they're like, why did I let that leave my studio? Why did I feel pressured? like, it wasn't ready.
But yeah. There's a famous story, isn't there, of an artist who goes back into a collector's home, seduces the collector to become friends with them, and then takes a pencil and starts, when they're in the kitchen, starts changing the work on the wall.
No!
Yeah.
What?
Carmen told me about it. It's a really
who
brilliant
was the
story.
Artist? Oh, that's
it's quite a famous. It's quite a famous artist. It's someone like, you know, like Van Gogh or somebody. And they used to go to the collector's house and then start editing the work.
Well, it wouldn't be Van Gogh because
so...
he didn't sell anything in his lifetime. So it wouldn't
okay,
have been
well,
him.
Not Van Gogh, but it was like an iconic artist, like de Kooning.
Just to pick you up
it
on
might
that
have
there,
been
yeah?
de Kooning or somebody.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
I'm gonna check it in anyway once I find okay. out.
It's like, sure. I mean, it sounds like
a really crazy
film.
Story.
There's a film in that somewhere.
Yeah, totally.
But there's a
yeah.
film in your life, totally. Isn't there, Josh? With like, would you ever want to play John Bunting, your granddad? Is he?
Well,
I mean, how would people find his work?
I think, I mean, you can find, I mean, basically by looking online, you can find a lot of his stuff. But the thing that kind of comes back a lot, and that I think there is a film in somewhere, is that he mm-hmm. spent most of his life building a war memorial chapel yes. in the middle of nowhere in Yorkshire, which
in
exists.
North Yorkshire, and I wanted to bring this up, yeah.
Completely extraordinary. It's one of the most beautiful spaces I've ever been to. And that's not just
it's completely hand built, isn't it?
Completely hand-built, and he built the stained glass windows, which are stunning. And then inside, I think it's just called the War Memorial Chapel at Thirsk.
And it's 1957.
Yeah, and so my mum grew up, you know, every single weekend going and sitting in the middle of nowhere in this forest while he would so carry on nice. Building this chapel, which I feel God. Like there's, you know, there's something in that. Whether I'd want to play on myself, I feel like, no, I don't know. I'd probably
what
rather
was his
get someone,
ears like?
Someone that you do it. His ears, yeah, it would either be you or me, Russell. I think.
Okay, so it's a family trait. He's got the ears. Yeah, so okay, cool. If you don't want to do I'll do it. Fine.
I saw great photos online of like an exhibition that someone had visited where your family put kind of wooden sculptures outdoors in the forest and stone sculptures
yeah.
as well, and it was like an open day or an open week or something. We
yeah.
got to go and visit it all and see the exhibition. It looked so brilliant in that context.
Oh, it was amazing. And what's amazing is there's so many people who kind of stumble. I think there's a footpath just
yes.
out, just kind of beyond where people would walk through. And
yeah, there's,
over
there's
time,
like
it's
National
kind of
Trust
people have
websites.
Yeah, people have sort of spotted it and come over, and so I think my uncle started doing a few open days where we'd showcase his art and things like that. But yeah, the Royal. I mean, the other place, the Royal Sculptors Society, I think, which is in Kensington, they've been incredibly supportive and seem to have a lot of his work and have been really helpful to us in organising some exhibitions. So. So his work is slightly niche, but you can find it, basically. It is out
and
there.
Talking about you acting in a biopic, I think that's what they call them, isn't it? I'd almost imagine maybe you might want to play a footballer, because aren't you a massive Southampton FC fan?
I am a big fan.
You wanted to be a footballer, didn't you? It was a footballer, actor, or artist
yeah,
as a kid, right?
I really wanted to be a footballer for a long time. But then I think, I mean, it was, you know, it's one of those things where I think I wanted to be a footballer for a long time until it became very clear, and it was quite quick that it becomes clear that you're not nowhere near good enough.
Right.
And also I think, I mean, realistically, looking back, the things that excited me about football, I remember playing football with a Sunday league side, and the thing that I used to come into the change rooms and be like, guys, I've got this amazing idea for a design for our new kit next season, and they were Josh, we couldn't care less about
this. Yeah.
and probably, you know, took the mick out of me for doing that. So I think I think I should have known really that I was better suited to
you're more visually
Stephen Meisel's
foods. Yes.
yes. So it didn't last very long.
So we ask every guest on Talk Art two questions. They're very difficult, so you better prepare yourself, but you might already know the answers because I guess you've heard a few episodes. But the first question is, if you could do an imaginary art heist where you take home an artwork of any scale, size, anything you really love, or if you don't want to steal something, it could just be a touchstone, what would you take home?
So I have my answers. Basically, I have two pieces that I've always... loved, and they're very different. So I would really love to have the Angel of the North in my garden.
Gormley, yes.
By Gormley. Yeah, and it sounds mad, but it is the one piece where I didn't even realize it was a piece of art growing up. I remember driving along the motorway and seeing it as a young kid and being sort of terrified by it. But it remains this beacon that feels very homely and feels like home to me. And I think that combined by the fact that my grandfather taught him. It feels like an extra special piece. So there's that.
It is quite terrifying. You're right. It is a terrifying, ominous figure.
I know, no one ever seems to talk about it. And every time I hear people talking about Hadrian's Wall, all they say is like, isn't it wonderful? No, it's beautiful. Terrifying.
I remember driving past it, though, and thinking how majestic it is in real life.
Yeah.
Like in real life, because in photographs, I never really understood it or got it.
No, it doesn't.
And then when I remember driving past a few times, and especially when the light, if the sun's going down or that kind of time of day.
Yeah.
I remember seeing it once and it was actually really quite extraordinary. And it shocked me how extraordinary it was, because I think I'd already made up my mind that it wasn't my favorite thing by him or something.
It's got a War of the Worlds vibe to me. It feels like it's this, it's been placed there by aliens or some other kind of like the Easter Island sculptures and stuff, like like Peruvian sort of, like, I mean, placed there by these ancient people we know nothing about, along with Stonehenge.
It has that
vibe about it.
Yeah, totally.
Well, thanks for that one, because that's like that's gonna be really easy just to go and
the
three of us can lift that up and carry that down the A4E. We'd be fine.
Easy to carry. But the other one is a Noguchi. Do you know Noguchi?
Yeah,
I'd love any of Noguchi's work. So I think I feel like if I couldn't have the Angel of the North, I had to have a second one. It would have to be one of those.
Where have you seen them?
I've never seen one for real. But there's a beautiful sculpture which is like I don't even know the name of it, but it's a huge rock that's like hanging on what looks like a sort of a bar from a ballet studio. And it's one of the most beautiful things I've seen. So I'd love to.
And that's very your taste, isn't it? That
your aesthetic,
his work.
So one of those, Josh.
Right, we sort that out. And then the other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour and why?
Okay, so I think my favourite colour is mustard yellow. And the reason is because it is my grandmother's favorite color and seems to appear a lot in her ceramics. And she was of the kind of generation where you wouldn't throw away plastic. And so her whole studio was covered in these, old plastic biscuit boxes, which all had yellow kind of turn top lids, and they were sort of a mustard yellow, and it remains my favorite color, and my flat is covered in the stuff. So mustard yellow.
Sweet.
That's so nice. We do have one bonus question, actually, Rob, don't we? Now we're all in lockdown.
You do it, Russ.
Well, what have you discovered since we've all been in quarantine that is your hidden lockdown talent, something you didn't know?
And if you haven't
had
found
before,
one yet, because we're still at the beginning of lockdown, but what would you like it to be?
Okay, so I think my lockdown talent, and actually I don't know whether it is a talent, so it might be a combination of, I think it's a talent, and if it's not a talent, I'm going to make it a talent, is gardening. So I've been spending my whole time gardening, and I planted some bulbs today, and I've started my own compost heap.
You're from another era.
Be a gardener.
Yeah, it's not that surprising. Right?
You are wartime.
Farm.
You are like the wartime.
He worked on the farm in God's own country. Technically a farmer.
I'm basically a farmer.
He's got all the skills.
Yeah, thanks.
You've actually learned all those skills because you're a method actor.
It's a real life method actor. It exists. Although it'd be the farmer I work with on God's own country would be not that impressive by gardening right now, I'm sure.
You're going to have an allotment one day, aren't you? You're going to be someone with an allotment.
I'm already on a waiting list. I'm actually already on a waiting list for an allotment in North London. But apparently it's like 20 years. So in 20 years' time, I'll have an allotment.
Oh, somebody has to die and then you can get in. Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly.
Being a BAFTA member.
Is that how it works?
I think it used to be, yeah. I think it used to be, yeah. There's only a certain select number, so someone's dying. They're like, you're whatever welcome to Mapper. And you're like, happy, oh, yeah. Somebody's died. Yeah, this is quite a sad occasion, isn't it? Me joining.
I think most BAFTA members probably have an allotment as well, to be honest.
Yes,
I feel like that's how it works.
That's true.
It goes hand in hand. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Josh. It has been so cool and fun and interesting. I feel like I've learned a lot, actually. So, good one.
I've always seen you, Josh, as like the male Tilda Swinton.
That's so cool.
That is a compliment.
Yeah, I just think you're a genius, and I love what you do, and I'm so proud that you're on here. But I do, I really do.
I love Tilda. That's so lovely.
I just want to tap on one thing. You're swimming for Mind Charity at the moment, and you're doing 30 swims in. How is that all going?
30 swims. So it's going quite well. So the idea was 30 wild swims in my 30th year to raise money for Mind Charity. I'm on 26, and now that we're in lockdown, it's slightly tricky. So I've got to do it before my birthday on the 20th of May. I'm hoping that a bit of the lockdown's lifted. They have to be at different places, and it has to be in the UK. So I've done lots in Scotland, in locks, in ponds, in lakes, and I've got 4 left. So we sort of got to pray for the lockdown to lift. If it doesn't, then I might extend it a bit, because I think that's only
I think you're going to have to, because it wasn't like your fault that you missed them.
No, exactly, right?
And I think most things are being extended, like, you know. I feel like
people still sponsor you for this.
People can still sponsor me. Yeah, I'm so bad at publicizing myself. Yeah. I don't know why. Yeah. But
we're going to publicize it. And actually, you just got another donation, because I'm now going to donate.
Yeah. Oh, is it a link off of your Instagram as well? Is it connected
there's
to that?
A link on my Instagram, and it's like a GoFundMe thing, and you you click on it, and then you can donate. Yeah,
and just remind me who you're raising money for
Mind Charity.
Okay, great.
Mental health charity.
Yeah. Amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah. Amazing, Josh. We love you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, Rob.
For all images about today's, we talked about in today's episode, please follow us on at TalkArt on Instagram. And then Josh is at Josh O'Graffy on Instagram. So you'll be able to see a lot of his drawings. He won't ever give you one, but you can look at them. And
to be honest, if Xavier Dolan can't get one, I mean, I don't know who will get one. Maybe
Xavier will get his one day. He will get one.
I would love Xavier to come on this show, actually. I love Xavier.
It should be an art swap. Yeah, you give him a drawer and he gives you a part. There we go.
A film, yeah. I love that. It's a good
exactly.
idea.
Exactly. All right. Cheers,
okay,
everyone.
We'll be back soon. Bye.
Thanks. Big love.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.